Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, serving the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast as part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source for community news and information. The Ledger delivers information and entertainment to the print-impaired, the blind, and those with low vision, read by our Cape-based volunteers, as well as select reading services around the country, and our partner broadcaster, the Talking Information Center in Marshfield. You may sometimes hear their content, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger that's broadcasting it, read by our Cape volunteers 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. My name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of the Cape Cod Times, dated today, Tuesday, June 30th. We start, as we always do, with the weather. Cape Cod forecast reads, there will be areas of low clouds and fog around for a while early today. Then clouds will break for sunshine on a couple of occasions, especially this afternoon. However, there will also be a couple of showers around, as well as thunderstorms later this afternoon and into this evening, which could become heavy and gusty. Clouds should break later tonight and some fog may return. Extended forecast reads, more unsettled weather is expected during midweek. There'll be intervals of clouds and sunshine on both Wednesday and Thursday, as well as a shower and thunderstorm on a couple of occasions. It'll start to turn progressively warmer later this week, with temperatures creeping back up to near 80 by Friday. There should also be some sunshine on Independence Day, which is the beautiful 4th of July. The marine forecast calls for wind northeast 6 to 12 knots today, seas 2 to 4 feet on the ocean, 1 to 3 feet on the bay, with visibility under 2 miles in showers and thunderstorms, which may be expected a little later, as you heard. The sunrise was at 5:10 a.m. It'll set at 8:19. We are starting to wane on the daylight, 15 hours 9 minutes. It was 15 hours 10 minutes yesterday. The moonrise is at 3:31 p.m. It'll set at 1:47 a.m. We head to the front of the paper for the lottery results. The lottery results are read because somebody asked us to. If you'd like us to read something to the low vision listeners that we have, by all means, email me at info@audiblelocalledger.org and we'll consider reading it. The numbers game in the evening, drawn Monday, 9640. The numbers game midday, drawn Monday, 2691. Sunday night's late numbers for mass cash were 5, 9, 17, 28, and 33. On to the cover of today's Cape Cod Times and the headline above the fold. It's a big banner headline with a picture of a lot of people with masks holding up signs. Supreme Court strikes down abortion clinic law. Chief Justice Roberts angers conservative by siding with liberals to throw out Louisiana statute. By David G. Savage of the Tribune News Service in Washington. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. joined the Supreme Court's liberal justices to deal a surprising setback to abortion opponents on Monday, striking down a restrictive Louisiana abortion law and reaffirming the court's past rulings that have upheld a woman's right to choose. By a 5-4 vote, the court threw out a Louisiana law that would have required abortion doctors have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. If put into effect, it was expected to result in the closing of all but one of the state's abortion providers. It came as no surprise that the four liberal justices opposed the law since they struck down a similar Texas law 4 years ago. But the Chief Justice, a conservative who's consistently opposed abortion rights in the past and had voted to uphold the Texas law, cast the fifth vote with them, citing precedent as his reason. It was the court's first abortion ruling since President Donald Trump's two appointees took their seats, and it dashed hopes of abortion opponents who expected the more conservative court to move to repeal Roe v. Wade, or at least give states more power to narrow it. It also marked the third major decision in the past 2 weeks in which the Chief Justice joined with the court's four liberals. The court extended workplace protections for LGBTQ employees and blocked Trump's repeal of the Obama-era policy that protected so-called Dreamers from deportation. A statement from the White House press secretary called the decision unfortunate, quote-unquote, adding that unelected justices have intruded on the sovereign prerogatives of state governments by imposing their own policy preference in favor of abortion to override legitimate abortion safety regulations. Anti-abortion advocates cast the loss in political terms, saying the ruling underscored the need to re-elect Trump in November so he could appoint another conservative justice to provide the fifth vote needed to repeal Roe v. Wade. "Today's ruling is a bitter disappointment," said Marjorie Dannenfeiser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, which opposes abortion. "It's imperative that we re-elect President Trump and our pro-life majority in the U.S. Senate so we can further restore the judiciary, more especially the Supreme Court." Former Vice President Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, said the November election would be critical to protecting abortion rights. "Let's be clear, Republicans and state legislatures will stop at nothing to get rid of Roe, and we have to be just as strong in our defense of it," Biden said. "They're trying to get these laws appealed to the Supreme Court in the hope that Trump's justices will vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. It's wrong, it's pernicious, and we have to stop it." Roberts, in a 16-page concurring opinion for June Medical Services v. Russo, said he didn't agree with the legal reasoning in Justice Stephen Breyer's ruling, joined by the three other liberal justices, which said that the court should balance the health costs and benefits of each abortion regulation. A similar argument was used to strike down the Texas law, but Roberts concluded, nevertheless, that the court should honor the outcome of the Texas decision. "The legal doctrine of stare decisis requires us, absent special circumstances, to treat like cases alike. The Louisiana law imposes a burden on access to abortion just as severe as that imposed by the Texas law, for the same reasons. Therefore, Louisiana's law cannot stand under our precedent," he said. Roberts' decision to cross the ideological divide to support a liberal precedent is in keeping with his stated concerns that the court is increasingly viewed by Americans through a partisan lens. In public statements, Roberts likes to say the justices do not decide cases as Republicans or Democrats. Some Senate Republicans turned their ire on the Chief Justice. "If the court cares about preserving its legitimacy as a non-political institution, then it shouldn't make decisions based on how its judgments will be perceived politically," said Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican from Nebraska. "The problem with today's decision is absolutely terrible jurisprudence, simply bad lawyering." Roberts' opinion on Monday suggested he would uphold some abortion regulations, but not those that greatly hamper women. Roberts also described as precedent the court's 1992 ruling in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which reaffirmed the central principle of Roe v. Wade that states may not put a substantial obstacle in front of women seeking abortions. But in a line that might worry abortion rights advocates, Roberts also noted that in the Louisiana case, neither party has asked us to reassess the constitutional validity of that standard. That left open the possibility that he'd be open to overturning Roe v. Wade and the right to abortion if that question were squarely presented to the court. Roberts' defection does not bode well for at least a dozen Republican states that have enacted laws in the past 2 years that would severely limit, or entirely ban, abortion. For years, former Justice Anthony M. Kennedy, a moderate Republican appointee, has cast the deciding votes with liberals to maintain the right to abortion. And in another Supreme Court decision, which is an inset on the front page, Supreme Court clears way for federal executions to resume. Marathon bomber Jokhar Tsarnaev is one of 62 federal death row prisoners, by Richard Wolfe, reporting for USA Today. In Washington, the Supreme Court cleared the way Monday for the Trump administration to resume federal executions for the first time in 17 years. The justices denied a challenge from four convicted murderers who argued that federal executions must adhere to the specific protocols used by the states where each man was sentenced, including the method of execution. Associate Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor said they would have heard the challenge. Attorney General William Barr announced last year that the federal government would conduct its first execution since 2003 using the single drug pentobarbital. The drug is used in many, but not all, states. Federal District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan ruled that the executions would conflict with provisions of a 1994 federal law, under which the federal government is supposed to follow protocols used by the states in which the prisoners were sentenced. That ruling was upheld by a 3-judge federal appeals court panel. 14 states, led by Arizona, had sided with the Justice Department, telling the High Court that pentobarbital is a fast-acting barbiturate that can reliably induce and maintain a coma-like state that renders a person insensate to pain. The Supreme Court temporarily blocked the executions in December, but said it expected the challenge would be handled by the appeals court with appropriate dispatch. 3 conservative associate justices, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, indicated at the time they expected the Trump administration to prevail within 60 days and the executions could go forward. A 3-judge appeals court panel, including 2 of President Donald Trump's nominees, allowed the executions to proceed, prompting the latest Supreme Court petition. Barr then directed the Federal Bureau of Prisons to schedule 4 executions, including for 3 of the inmates involved in the ongoing litigation. They're slated for July 13 through 17 at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. The 4 inmates seeking the court's intercession were unanimously convicted more than 15 years ago of brutal crimes, including murder, torture, and rape. Children were among the murder victims in each case. Only 3 men have been executed by the government since the federal death penalty was restored in 1988. The first was Timothy McVeigh, executed in 2001 for the 1995 bombing of an Oklahoma City federal building in which 168 people died. Among the 62 federal death row prisoners are Jokar Tsarnaev, convicted in the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, and Dylan Roof, who killed 9 people inside a Charleston, South Carolina church in 2015. The inmates scheduled for execution are Danny Lee, who was convicted in Arkansas of killing a family of 3, including an 8-year-old, Wesley Ira Perkey of Kansas, who raped and murdered a 16-year-old girl and killed an 80-year-old woman, Dustin Lee Honkin, who killed 5 people in Iowa, including 2 children, and Keith Dwayne Nelson, who kidnapped a 10-year-old girl who was rollerblading in front of her Kansas home, raped her in a forest behind a church before strangling the young girl with a wire. Oh my God. It can't come quick enough. 3 of the executions for Lee, Perkley, and Honkin are scheduled days apart beginning July 13th. Nelson's execution is scheduled for August 28th. The Justice Department said additional executions will be set at a later date. Ruth Friedman, an attorney for Lee, decried the federal death penalty as arbitrary, racially biased, and rife with poor lawyering and junk science. Despite these problems, and even as people across the country are demanding that leaders rethink crime, punishment, and justice, the government's barreling ahead with its plans to carry out first federal executions in 17 years. Perkey's lawyers separately filed court papers last week asking a federal judge to halt his execution, arguing that he isn't mentally fit to be executed because he suffers from advancing Alzheimer's disease and deteriorating cognitive functioning. The lawyers argue Perkey doesn't understand why the government plans to execute him, and he believes it's retaliation for his many complaints about conditions in the federal prison system. Overall, more than 1,500 prisoners have been executed since the 70s, nearly 40% of them in Texas. But the number of executions in the states has declined steadily for the past 2 decades. The Associated Press contributed to that article. Tough to read some of those crimes, I have to say. Face mask dispute leads to assault charges. The next headline on the cover of today's Cape Cod Times. Just a reminder, we're reading you Tuesday, June 20th's e-edition. Springfield man allegedly struck 81-year-old restaurant owner in Provincetown by Jessica Hill in Orleans. A Springfield man pleaded not guilty Monday to assault charges connected to an altercation fueled by an argument over face masks Saturday night at George's Pizza in Provincetown. Angel Gomez, 27 years old, pleaded not guilty to charges of assault and battery on a person over the age of 60, providing false information to law enforcement and disorderly conduct during his Orleans District Court arraignment. He asked for a Spanish interpreter for the hearing. Police responded to a 911 call about 9:37 p.m. Saturday night for reports of a fight in progress at the 275 Commercial Street restaurant. Gomez allegedly struck the restaurant's owner, 81-year-old George Craniotakis, who refused medical treatment. Gomez said he was with family members at George's Pizza when a shouting match erupted. Craniotakis came out from behind the counter and allegedly got into Gomez's face and started yelling at him to speak English and not Spanish, his attorney, Henry Curtis, said during the hearing. Francine Craniotakis, George's daughter, said in an interview after the arraignment that Gomez and his group came in and refused to sit down at a table. They weren't wearing their masks when we asked them to. My dad came around and asked them to sit down and put on their masks. The guy said something like, "We don't want to." Francine said that at that point, her dad, who doesn't speak fluent English, told them if they wouldn't cooperate, they'd have to leave. That's when Gomez hit him, she said. Curtis said Craniotakis got within inches of Gomez's face and Gomez defended himself and pushed Craniotakis away before leaving the restaurant. Gomez and his group left George's Pizza and went to McMillan Pier, where another altercation occurred with an employee of the restaurant. Assistant Cape and Island District Attorney Max Mitrokostas said during the arraignment. A police officer watched a video of the incident in the restaurant and concluded that Gomez hit Craniotakis with an open-handed strike to the face, not a closed fist, Curtis said during the arraignment. The strike left the restaurant owner dazed and confused. I'm going to remind the listener, this owner is 81 years old. This is a 27-year-old man hitting him, slapping him across the face because he won't wear a mask and he won't sit down. Wear the damn mask. Ugh. When Gomez and his group left the restaurant, an employee followed them to McMillan Pier, where the employee assaulted and tried to grab Gomez by the neck, Curtis said. Gomez's cousin was punched in the neck, was punched in the mouth and received treatment from first responders, he said. Andrew Chartier, a cook and bartender at the restaurant, said in a phone interview that he and another bartender at the restaurant chased the group down to the pier and tried to tackle them. He said it took 10 to 15 minutes for police to show up, during which time Gomez bit his arm. Police let the other members of Gomez's group go, and Chartier's wound was cleaned by an ambulance crew. After the police left, Chartier said, the same group jumped him in the parking lot and kicked him. I don't think the cops handled the situation very well, Chartier said. Francine said the experience has made her wary of having customers inside the restaurant. She didn't want customers inside, but restaurant staff decided to allow patrons inside Saturday due to the rain. We're trying to enforce Governor Baker's rules, and this is the end result, she said. I'm very angry and I'm very upset. My father is my heart. He is a huge, upstanding member of this community. Gomez gave police officers the wrong last name and was only identified based on his fingerprints, Mitrokostas said. Curtis said Gomez came to the U.S. from Puerto Rico about 6 or 7 years ago and lives with his grandmother. He said Gomez has maintained good contact with his probation officer assigned to his case out of Hamden County. Bail was set at $2,500, but Judge Robert Welsh decided to hold Gomez, who's already on probation for possession of a firearm without a permit, and distribution of a Class B drug from a case out of Hamden County Superior Court. His next hearing for the Provincetown charges is scheduled for August 4th. Yuck. Yeah, some of these stories are tough to read. I'm sorry, people. I read what's written, though. And what is written in the final story for the Cape Cod Times today is Provincetown Film Festival, back by popular demand. Canceled in May, the event finds new life online and at the Wellfleet Drive-In. And this is reported by Kathy Scritzy Driscoll. The 2020 Provincetown International Film Festival is back from the dead. The annual event, celebrating on-the-edge filmmakers, is now called Provincetown Reimagined and will offer a mix of live events over 2 nights at the Wellfleet Drive-In, plus a dozen movies for fans to watch at home. It all came together very quickly. We're really thrilled, artistic director Lisa Viola said. We're so happy that given this year, with everything going on, that we could do anything. The announcement Monday came just a month after the Provincetown Film Society, which produces the festival, laid off its 3 year-round full-time and 6 part-time staffers. The layoffs included the new CEO of the Society and Festival and employees at the temporarily closed Water's Edge Cinema. In addition, about 50 festival staffers were laid off in March. A May press release confirmed the annual film festival, usually held in mid-June, was canceled, and said the Board of Trustees would spend the summer evaluating the finances and operations of the organization after the great financial hardship caused by the COVID-19 outbreak. What changed? Enough people didn't want the festival to be gone. Officials at both Warner Media, parent company of HBO that's been the presenting sponsor for years, and representatives from Wellfleet Drive-In almost immediately contacted festival staff and offered to help, according to Viola. Staffers had already organized a majority of the in-person festival by March when the pandemic shut everything down, and had already been offering ideas to save the festival. Filmmakers and Provincetown business owners quickly jumped on board, too. It feels like a real community effort, Viola said. Everyone dug in and decided they wanted to make this thing happen no matter what. The staff said we have to do something for the community. We have to say we're here. A core staff of 10 have now reimagined the festival to run July 16th through 19th. Opening night screenings at Wellfleet Drive-In, a socially distanced venue used for past festivals, include Misha Richter's documentary I Am a Town, shot entirely in Provincetown, and Save Yourselves, a 2020 Sundance Film Festival hit about a couple who turn off technology only to miss an alien attack. Film director and Provincetown resident John Waters, a regular host at past festivals, will choose and host films at the second drive-in night. Actress Maya Taylor, who became the first transgender actress to win a major film award when she received a 2015 Independent Spirit Award for Tangerine, will receive the festival's Next Wave Award and do a recorded interview in connection with the screening of her movie, Stage Mother. The award recognizes artists who have exciting and distinctive voices, take artistic risks, and have a passionate commitment to independent film. The entire film lineup is due to be announced July 7th, when tickets go on sale. Movies chosen for at-home screenings, according to officials, will continue the festival's longtime support of emerging artists from underrepresented communities telling stories that unite and inspire us, and will offer themes of diversity, equity, and inclusion. There will be some recorded filmmaker interviews available as well, Viola said. Provincetown organizers were encouraged that this could work because of successful virtual festivals put on elsewhere, including the current Nantucket Film Festival. In some ways, this option offers a democratizing of this year's event, Viola said, allowing participation by people who might not have been able to afford to or logistically get to be in Provincetown. And the virtual concept may not go away post-pandemic. Once we test out the virtual festival, that may become a component of festivals going forward, Viola said. We're seeing this as an opportunity to expand a little bit beyond the four walls of the theater venues. From the log section on page 2, the first note reads, one person injured in crash involving utility pole in Hyannis. One person was injured after a Toyota sedan struck a utility pole Sunday night at 130 Lewis Bay Road. Hyannis police and fire personnel responded to a call at about 8:23 p.m. for a report of a single vehicle crash, according to Hyannis Fire Captain Jeffrey Huska. One person was taken to Cape Cod Hospital with minor injuries and another person refused treatment. The sedan was moderately damaged, as was the utility pole, Huska said. Eversource came to the scene to take a look at the pole. Huska said the space around the pole might have to be refilled as the pole shifted slightly when it was hit. That was reported by Jessica Hill, as was this other note in the log. Firefighters rescue people stranded on breakwater in Hyannis. Members of the Hyannis Fire Department rescued several people Sunday night on the Hyannis Port breakwater after they got stranded by the rising tide. A caller reported at about 8:48 p.m. Sunday that they got stuck while fishing and couldn't come back after the tide rose, Hyannis Fire Captain Jeffrey Huska said. Firefighters responded with marine units and an ambulance. Five people were shuttled onto the Hyannis Port Marine docks. Firefighters also assisted some people who were able to get back themselves, and nobody was injured, Huska said. It's a common thing that happens out there, he said. They don't realize they're going to be cut off. Huska said people need to check when the tide will be high in order to avoid getting stranded. In brief, on page 2, Orleans Committee plans flyover to celebrate July 4th. A flyover ceremony and a parade in place are part of the town's reimagined 4th of July celebrations this year. COVID-19 may have struck down plans for larger celebrations, but the 4th of July committee brainstormed until they came up with appropriate ways to celebrate the nation's birthday. I knew we could host a virtual event, committee chairwoman Jennifer Allard wrote in a June 29th statement. I knew our committee was a creative bunch, and we could do something more. This year's celebration will kick off at 10 a.m. with a flyover including three Cessna planes, a biplane with smoke, and a banner plane. The planes will fly from Nauset Beach to Rock Harbor and Skagit Beach, weather permitting. The Orleans July 4th Facebook page will live stream 30 minutes of patriotic music, curated by committee members beginning at 10 a.m. Residents and business owners are encouraged to decorate their yards, homes, and businesses with 4th of July decorations for the event. People are also encouraged to post pictures using the hashtag Orleans4thofJuly. We may be celebrating differently this year, but our patriotism and love of Orleans are greater than ever, Allard wrote in the statement. And that was reported by Denise Coffey. Worldwide slowdown in fishing unlikely to save rare species, by Patrick Whittle and Christina Larson of the Associated Press in Portland, Maine. Commercial fishing taking place worldwide has dipped since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, but scientists and conservation experts say it's unclear if the slowdown will help endangered species of marine life recover. Hours logged by fishermen at sea fell by nearly 10% around the world after the March 11th declaration of a pandemic, and in some hard-hit countries such as China, fishing completely stopped. The fishing decline has spurred questions about food security, ocean management, and global trade. As countries begin to resume fishing, new questions are emerging about whether an extended fishing slowdown could help rare ocean animals, such as the North Atlantic right whale. The whale numbers only about 400 and is vulnerable to fatal entanglement in fishing gear. Less fishing could also help jeopardized fish stocks of the Mediterranean Sea, which is home to the overfished Atlantic bluefin tuna. And many rare species are vulnerable to accidental catch, called bycatch, in fishing gear. But it's too early to hail the respite from fishing lines and nets, said David Krudzma, Director of Research and Innovation for the nonprofit Global Fishing Watch. And since millions of people rely on fishing for their livelihoods and sustenance, any benefit to sea life has come at a cost, he said. I don't think we should be celebrating anything here, not by making people suffer incredibly, Krudzma said. I bet what we'll find is it is not sufficient for rebuilding stocks in places they have to rebuild. Fishermen around the world logged about 6.8 million hours at sea from March 11th to April 28th. That's down about 700,000 hours from averages over the previous 2 years, according to data compiled by Global Fishing Watch. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN said the pandemic has brought changing consumer demands, market access, or logistical problems that could keep fishing difficult indefinitely. Couple draw guns at crowd heading to St. Louis mayor's home, by the Associated Press in St. Louis. A white couple stood outside their mansion and pointed guns at protesters in St. Louis as the group marched toward the mayor's home to demand her resignation. Police said people in the crowd yelled threats at the couple. Mark McCloskey, 63, told a TV station that he and his wife Patricia, both personal injury lawyers, were facing an angry mob on their private street and feared for their lives Sunday night. No charges were brought against them. Police said they were still investigating, but labeled it a case of trespassing and assault by intimidation against the couple by protesters in the racially diverse crowd. The marchers were angry at Mayor Lyda Crewson for reading aloud the names and addresses of several residents who wrote letters calling for defunding the police department. The group of at least 500 people chanted, "Resign, Lida. Take the cops with you," news outlets reported. A social media video showed Mark McCluskey and his 61-year-old wife standing outside their Renaissance Palazzo-style home in the city's well-to-do Central West End neighborhood. He could be heard yelling while holding a long-barreled gun. His wife stood next to him with a handgun. Police said the couple had heard a loud commotion in the street and saw a large group of people break an iron gate marked with "no trespassing" and private street signs. Police said the man and woman told the marchers to leave. They were on a private street. But people in the crowd yelled obscenities and threats, police said. The man and woman said they saw people who were armed, so they armed themselves and called police, according to authorities. We are at the midway point of our broadcast, and regular listeners are well aware it is at this stage in the reading when we move to our obituaries. And today, there are 5 obituaries. Our first obituary is of Nancy Lee Simons Koenig of Newtonville, who passed at the age of 86 on June 27th. Nancy was born in Boston and had private graveside services. Expressions of sympathy in her memory may be made to the VNA of Boston, VNA Care, Fund Development Office in Danvers, or to Spalding Hospital in Cambridge. The next obituary is of Ari Levy Boz of Bourne, who at the age of 88 passed on June 27th. Ari was born February 12, 1932, in Berlin, Germany. His family was originally from a beautiful town in Holland named Zutphen. In 1937, his dad and mom immigrated to Australia to escape Nazi Germany. In 1939, Ari, his brother Joe, and Aunt Helen joined his mom and dad in Australia. Today, in Australia, Ari leaves behind the wonderful Boss family, B-O-S. His sister-in-law, Bev Boss, nephew Phil Boss, nieces Debbie, Miriam, Jackie, as well as their spouses, and their children. Ari has been married 4 times, but he had 2 significant families. Ari was a world traveler and a self-made man. He lived and worked in many countries, but most cherished being American. His favorite state in America was Hawaii, where you could find him kayaking at backyards on the North Shore. An education fund has been set up for Sienna K. Boss, care of Northeast Federal Credit Union, in Manchester, Connecticut. A private graveside service will be held at the South Monument Cemetery in Bourne. Our next obituary is of Peter J. Canone of Sandwich, who at the age of 77 passed away on June 27th. Peter was born September 9th, 1942 in Holyoke, Mass. He attended Holyoke High School, where he met his beloved wife, Catherine, and the two were married for 55 years. Peter loved his family and his work as an educator and the many thousands of lives he touched and the friends he made along that way. When he was not working, his great joys were spending time with his family and all of his grandchildren at his home on Cape Cod or vacationing in Ogunquit, Maine. He was so proud of his entire family. Peter graduated from University of Massachusetts. He then went on to receive his master's degree in school administration from Westfield State College. Peter served in education for over 50 years. He started his career at Granby High School teaching biology and general science. Peter then went on to East Longmeadow High School, where he served for 24 years, starting as a biology teacher, assistant principal, and then principal. Peter rose to associate superintendent at East Longmeadow Public Schools, then moved on to become superintendent of Sandwich Public Schools, where he spent 11 years enjoying every minute of his time. He retired in 2005, but that was short-lived as his passion for education didn't go away. He went on to become a professor at Bridgewater State University and also lead consultant at the Center for Executive Search, placing some of the top superintendents of schools on Cape Cod and the South Shore. Peter is survived by his wife Catherine and their 3 children and their families. A massive Christian burial will be held on Friday, July 3rd at 11 a.m. at Corpus Christi Parish, 326 Quaker Meeting House Road in Sandwich. A burial will follow at Sandwich Town Cemetery. Visiting hours will be Thursday, July 2nd from 4 to 7 p.m. at Nickerson Bourne Funeral Home, 154 Route 6A in Sandwich. Due to the current COVID-19 pandemic, face masks will be required and social distancing will be enforced, with a maximum of 40 people allowed in the funeral home at one time. Our next obituary is of a veteran, Robert J. Mulvey, Deputy Fire Chief of Brookline Fire Department, retired, of Yarmouth. Robert J. Mulvey, Deputy Fire Chief, Brooklyn Fire Department, 38 years of service, died of West Roxbury, formerly of Brookline, South Yarmouth, and Milton, on June 29th. Beloved husband of the late Rose Mulvey, loving father of Robert Mulvey, adored grandfather of Robert and Brian, dear brother of late Ann Thomas and Catherine Ryan, longtime companion of the late Dorothy McCaffrey of West Yarmouth, also survived by many nieces and nephews, late Army Air Force veteran of World War II. Funeral mass will be private. Visiting hours have been omitted. The interment will be at the Mass National Cemetery in Bourne. Mr. Mulvey, thank you for your service. And our final obituary for today, and a reminder, we are reading you obituaries for today, June 30th, it's a Tuesday, is of Charles L. Marr of Centerville, who passed on June 26th. He was born in Boston during a Valentine's Day snowstorm. Charlie lost his father at the age of 9 and became a young breadwinner for his mother and younger sister while living in West Roxbury. Some of his more memorable jobs were working at Fenway Park, as well as delivering ice and coal to Boston neighborhood homes. At the age of 15, he met his future bride, Evelyn, through mutual friends, while riding a streetcar heading to their respective high schools in Boston. Charlie tried to enlist in the U.S. Marine Corps at the age of 17, but his widowed mother would not sign the consent form. At age 18, Charlie did enlist in the Marines and eventually was stationed in San Diego, California at the end of World War II. In a queue to board a ship bound for a peacekeeping mission in China, he was pulled out of line so that his typing skills could be employed to process Marines returning from the Pacific. Charlie attended BC under the GI Bill. In later years, he would say his Uncle Sam paid for his college education. Upon graduation, Charlie went to work in the real estate division of the Shell Oil Company, where he secured commercial real estate locations for future gas stations. Charlie and Evelyn were married in 1952. They bought their first home in northeastern Massachusetts. Daughter Michelle and Christopher were soon to follow. A phone call several years later brought a job opportunity on Cape Cod, which Charlie eagerly embraced. As vice president of New Seabury Corp. in Mashpee, he was responsible for residential land and home sales, as well as running a water company. Living on the Cape also gave Charlie the opportunity to develop a passion for golf. He was a member of the Cumaquid Golf Club for 45 years. Charlie and his wife Evelyn were also avid members of the BC Club of Cape Cod and enjoyed traveling by bus to home football games at Chestnut Hill, where they tailgated with cherished friends from the club. They also proudly joined the club on the annual Cape Walk, which raised funds for Housing Assistance Corporation of Cape Cod. Charlie and Evelyn were members of Our Lady of Victory Church for over 50 years, where they served on the church's parish council. After Charlie's retirement in 1988, he and Evelyn became grandparents twice with the births of Katie and Chris. Grandson Tim and granddaughter Hillary joined the family in 1991 and 92. Charlie and Evelyn cherished spending time with their grandchildren, whether it was taking them to Dowses Beach, to Four Seas for ice cream, or to the driving range at Cumaquid. They were also always eager for the opportunity to babysit. His grandchildren fondly remember his dry sense of humor, with his reminders to duck of the head when he carried them down the stairs and keep your head down, a reference to hitting it straight in golf. preceded in death by his beloved wife Evelyn in 2019. Charlie is survived by his daughter Shelley, son Chris, and his four grandchildren. A funeral mass will be celebrated July 2nd at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Victory Church in Centerville. Interment will immediately follow at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne. In lieu of flowers, please consider making donations to Smile Train, the Wounded Warrior Project, or Heifer International. Mr. Marr, thank you for your service. That concludes the obituaries. We head back to the front part of the paper, where we have local news. Nantucket officials issue emergency mask order. Four new COVID-19 cases confirmed on island last week by Cynthia McCormick. The Nantucket Board of Health issued an emergency order requiring people to wear a face covering over their nose and mouth when in public and within 6 feet of another person. The order also says coverings must be worn at all times within the bounds of the Nantucket Old Historic District and Syosconset Historic District. The emergency order went into effect at 2 p.m. Monday. Masks should not be worn by children under the age of 2 and can be worn by children ages 2 to 5 at parental discretion, the official said. Nantucket Health Director Roberto Santa Maria said in a video message that the order was issued after Nantucket experienced 4 new cases of coronavirus last week. This is to slow down and stop the spread of COVID-19 on the island, Santa Maria said. DPH officials said Monday that 15 people on Nantucket have tested positive coronavirus since reporting on the pandemic started this winter, while 49 people have tested positive on Martha's Vineyard. In other coronavirus news Monday, State Senator Julian Sear, a Democrat from Truro, has been appointed to a newly established task force looking into how coronavirus has aggravated existing health disparities. The Massachusetts COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force is tasked with coming up with recommendations to improve safety for populations at increased risk of COVID-19, to remove barriers to care, increase access to medical supplies, and increase access to testing for COVID-19, among other things. COVID-19 has disproportionately sickened and killed people of color in Massachusetts, and the culprit is structural racism, bias, and discrimination, Sears said in a statement Monday. The task force is expected to report on its recommendations in late August. The task force is one of the provisions called for in a law signed by Governor Charlie Baker June 7th called An Act Addressing COVID-19 Data Collection and Treatment. The law also calls for state public health officials to include racial and demographic information as part of its COVID-19 reporting. Monday's statement said that in the days since the legislation was signed, the State Department of Public Health indicated that black and Hispanic individuals were 3 times more likely to test positive for COVID-19 in Massachusetts. Sear, who was appointed to the task force by Senate President Karen Spilka, said he looks forward to advancing racial justice in areas that the Commonwealth has ignored or denied for too long. State officials Monday reported 101 new cases of coronavirus across Massachusetts, including 89 cases confirmed by molecular testing for the live virus and 12 probable cases based on positive antibody tests combined with symptoms or exposure. The number of people in Massachusetts who have tested positive for coronavirus, which causes the disease of COVID-19, now stands at 108,768. State officials said Barnstable County had 3 new cases for a total of 1,535. Public health officials also reported 35 new deaths in Massachusetts, including one on Cape Cod, where a total of 145 people with coronavirus have died as of Monday. State officials said approximately 63% of coronavirus deaths, or 5,111, have occurred in residents of long-term care facilities. They said 23,409 residents and employees in long-term care centers have tested positive for coronavirus. The DPH Monday said 762 people in Massachusetts are hospitalized for treatment of COVID-19, which is a big drop since the peak of the pandemic in late April and early May. And of those hospitalized, 138 of those patients are in intensive care units. State officials Monday said Cape Cod Hospital in Hyannis has one coronavirus patient on the regular floor, none in ICU. Falmouth had six coronavirus patients with two in the ICU. Moving to the Cape and Islands section, as we head into the final quarter of our hour, political notes. Moran makes her mark on health care, by Jeff Spillane in Boston. State Senator Susan Moran, a Democrat from Falmouth, has been on the job less than a month, but her voice is already being heard on Beacon Hill. A Moran amendment to a major piece of health care legislation passed unanimously in the Senate on Thursday. The bill, an act putting patients first, focuses on increasing access and availability of high-quality health care in Massachusetts. It passed unanimously and is now headed to the House of Representatives. Moran's Essential Services Amendment would require Massachusetts Health Policy Commission to report on adverse impacts caused by the closure of any essential services at a hospital. A recent closing of maternity and pediatric units at Falmouth Hospital brought the issue to the forefront, Moran said. After a hearing last month, the Mass Department of Public Health determined services are essential to the community, but there's been no indication the hospital will reverse its decision. Unfortunately, my community and many others have had to face the realities of essential services being cut despite the DPH's best efforts, said Moran. This amendment will not only allow us to quantify the effect essential care closures have on the quality and availability of care to our constituents, but will also help determine how we can support DPH enforcement when these issues arise. Moran said she's concerned about the effect the closure of the maternity and pediatric units will have on the Upper Cape as a sustainable region for young families. It's one of the things people look at when they're buying homes, she said. New note. The League of Women Voters of Massachusetts has selected the winners of its Teen Voting Rights Challenge student video contest, and one of the honorees is from Cape Cod. The videos were intended to address the question of whether 16-year-olds should have the right to vote. Jacob Swenson, who graduates as class president from Sandwich High School this week, was the third-place winner with his submission entitled, A Stronger Democracy. I felt inspired because I realized how it makes more sense for more people to vote, said Swenson, who won $100 for his submission. For 16 and 17-year-olds, they're often paying taxes. They can be tried as adults and they can drive. If we can do all that, then why can't we vote? If young adults have that responsibility, then the government should also be representative to them. Swenson will attend the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. in the fall. Stephen Zarhos, a Republican candidate for state representative in the 5th Barnstable District, has been endorsed by Barnstable County Special Sheriff Jeffrey Perry. Perry held the seat from 2003 to 2011. Zarhos of West Barnstable faces Thomas Keyes of Sandwich in the Republican primary September 1st. The winner will square off against Democrat James Deaver of Sandwich in the general election November 3rd. Current state representative Randy Hunt, a Republican from Sandwich, is not seeking a sixth term in office. Another bullet point. Barnstable County Commissioner Ronald Beatty Jr. has received the endorsement of Linda Zwirn, a member of his Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates and a former born selectman. Beatty, a Republican, is seeking re-election to a second term in November. And he is quite controversial as well. If you are a sighted listener, you might want to look at some of his posts because they are definitely meant to inspire a reaction. U.S. Representative William Keating, Democrat from Massachusetts, tweeted this. This evening, we took a big step toward ending police brutality and racial profiling, increasing transparency, and ensuring that police are accountable to the communities they serve in passing the hashtag Justice in Policing Act, hashtag George Floyd Law. Other tweets, State Senator Julian Sear, Democrat from Truro, on June 26 tweeted, thrilled to see single-stall restrooms in the Senate's third-floor east wing, designated as all-gender. It matters that the People's House is welcoming to everyone. Plus, it's right next to my office. Thanks to @KarenSpilka for creating an inclusive workplace during hashtag Pride Month. And the final tweet from State Rep. Timothy Whalen on June 28th, Happy Sunday, friends. As we approach July 4th, please be mindful of others as you celebrate. Fireworks aren't fun for everyone. Please celebrate our nation's independence responsibly. Also from the Cape and Islands section, the headline reads, Judge Denies Motion to Reconsider in Highline Case by Ethan Genter of Barnstable. A 50% shareholder of Highline Cruises was dealt another blow earlier this month in the family legal squabble over the succession of his shares. Frederick Skip Scudder, who owns half of Hyannis Harbor Tours, the formal name of the ferry line and its other businesses, sued his cousins R. Murray Scudder, Philip Scudder, and Susan DiMartino, saying the three siblings who collectively own the other half of the company are trying to squeeze him out and prevent him from passing his shares down to his children. Skip Scudder filed a lawsuit against the trio in Barnstable Superior Court in December, but lost his initial push for a preliminary injunction and restraining order against them in March. In the past 2 months, Skip Scudder filed a motion to reconsider, asked for relief from the restraining order denial, and filed an amended complaint listing more examples of what he claimed was retaliation against him. But on June 10th, Judge Thomas Perino denied his motion to reconsider, and the cousins are pushing to get the case tossed. Quote, Frederick Scudder asserts new instances of alleged retaliation and requests relief in the nature of an order returning the status quo, identified by the plaintiff as corporate governance by unanimous consent of shareholders, Perino wrote. Whether or not that may be accomplished given the current relationship between the shareholders, the plaintiff has not demonstrated at this stage that such relief is appropriate where there exists a board of directors. The company was founded by Richard and Robert Scudder in 1962 and has been passed down through the family ever since. Skip Scudder said he consented to Richard Scudder passing down his shares to Murray Scudder, Philip Scudder, and Susan DiMartino, Richard Scudder's children, with the understanding that Skip Scudder would be able to do the same. According to Skip Scudder, the second largest ferry line on the Cape and Islands has been operating with unanimous consent between the shareholders, him and his three cousins, for years, until recently when the two factions came to an impasse. Much of Skip Scudder's argument hinges on the claim that a fictional board of directors was created by the cousins in an effort to override his 50% stake in the company. He says that the board was not duly elected and is now improperly engaged in adversarial conduct against him. He contends the board was created as a way for the cousins to outweigh him, giving each director a single vote instead of a weighted vote by shares. But Judge Perino previously ruled the company bylaws appear to allow for such a board, and there are several corporate documents indicating that Skip Scudder, whether knowingly or not, set the stage for the board's current activity. In his amended complaint, Skip Scudder brought forward new allegations from this May's stockholder meeting in which he sent one of his attorneys to be his proxy. The two factions proposed two different board of director slates. Skip Scudder's slate included himself, his wife Sandra, and their three children. The cousin's slate was the existing makeup of the board. Neither side could agree on the makeup, according to Skip Scudder's updated complaint, and Murray Scudder claimed that meant the current board was reelected. The new complaint also added five new counts, including a request for a judgment that the company go back to being ruled by a weekly family meeting and orders to allow Skip Scudder to transfer his shares to his family, possibly through a trust. The case has given a rare glimpse into the inner workings of Highline, which, unlike the Steamship Authority, is private. Despite the two setbacks in court, Skip Scudder's attorney, Bruce Beerhand, said he wasn't surprised by the judge's decision, but he was encouraged that the judge wants to see the case expedited. As long as the company continues to operate in normal course of business, there's no need for injunctive relief, according to Perino's previous ruling. A scheduling conference on the case is set for July 31st. The cousins have noted that they intend to file a motion to dismiss the case, but Beerhand said things are still in the early stages. In effect, we're in mile two of a marathon, he said. Philip Scudder on Monday denied the charges brought by his cousin, but declined to comment any further. And the final story in the Cape and Islands section of today's Cape Cod Times has a headline that reads, Yarmouth teacher wins national honor. Jennifer Peralt, named Massachusetts recipient of annual Sanford T. Teacher Award by Christine Legere in South Yarmouth. What's the secret to successfully teaching a classroom full of 7 and 8-year-olds? It's all about being engaging, according to Jennifer Perrault, a second-grade teacher at St. Pius X School and this year's Massachusetts winner of the National Sanford Teacher Award, which is given to teachers who bring commitment and inspiration to their classrooms. You have to really entertain them and keep them moving, Perrault said. Make sure they stay active. That comes easily to the 40-year-old born native thanks to her dramatic arts training while at Salve Regina University, where she earned a BFA degree with a double major of English and music and theater. Teaching's actually a second career for Perrault, who now lives in East Falmouth. After college, she initially went into marketing, but when she did a bit of substitute teaching in Falmouth, she discovered her true passion was educating children. I love to see their eyes light up when they learn something new, she said. Perrault then earned her master's degree in education from Lesley University. Her first year as a teacher was spent in the Falmouth Public Schools, where she taught one-on-one with a special needs student. 9 years ago, she took a position as a kindergarten teacher at St. Pius X School, but was switched to second grade after 3 years. One of Perrault's highest priorities is inspiring a strong sense of community among her students. We create the rules together, she said. We create community and empathy right from the start. When in-house classes abruptly halted in March due to the coronavirus, Perrault focused on how to educate her young students online while not overburdening them or their families. The challenge for them was not only facing social and emotional hurdles, but learning a new way to learn every day, she said. It was a struggle for parents who have children in other grades. We had to work around their Zoom calls. Perrault ran a Zoom instructional session each morning that lasted 30 to 45 minutes. In the afternoon, she'd hold another session with 5 or 6 children, rotating participants each day. Teaching assistant Joanne Ryder was a great help. She did video recorded read-alouds, journaling, and video book club with the kids, Perrault said. Perrault learned that she received the Sanford Teaching Award 2 weeks ago during a Zoom call with participants from around the country. A total of 51 were selected, one from each state and one from Washington, D.C. Each teacher is awarded $10,000, and each were asked by award organizers to put together a few sentences on teaching remotely for the Zoom session. Perrault wrote that she believed she inspired her students by making learning time more interactive, more exciting, and accessible for their various learning styles. I think one of the big takeaways for me was how much the kids inspired me by their creativity and adaptiveness and how they instantaneously switched to remote learning, she wrote. Award winners were told of their success during the Zoom call. All were excited and some, including Perrault, even cried. St. Pius principal Ann Daly said she wasn't surprised Perrault had been selected for the award. She demonstrates excellence in the classroom daily, creating a nurturing environment for all students where each learner is successful, Daly wrote in an email. She challenges her students and sets a wonderful example when facing challenges herself. This year, she undertook the challenge of distance learning with great enthusiasm and creativity, looking upon this period as an opportunity for growth and sharing this opportunity with her students and their families. Sanford Programs was established in 2014 through a gift from businessman and philanthropist T. Denny Sanford to provide innovative and inspirational education programs for teachers. Perrault was nominated for the award by St. Pius X school nurse Anne Agurkis. I've reached the end of our reading for today. If you know someone who could use our service, or you're interested in volunteering to read from home until we get back in the studio, hopefully it will be soon, if you're comfortable with doing that, or you're interested in donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air reading to those with low vision, the blind, and the print impaired, remember it's tax deductible. Please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audiblelocalledger.org. You can now listen to us on smart speakers like the Amazon Echo Dot just by saying these exact words: Alexa, play radio station Audible Local Ledger on TuneIn. And you'll have a clear static-free connection to our readings. As always, thank you for tuning in. and all your continued support. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well and be safe. Look after each other. Bye for now.